newsletter and details about the upcoming Tour de Trees bike events, all online at heartwoodtree.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Something seems to be happening in the field of cancer research and treatment. After years of using chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, or a combination of those treatments, new options are arriving at a quickening pace. Gene therapy has been around for about 15 years, but it has really ramped up in the last five. Doctors are also increasing their use of immunotherapy to attack tumors, and clinical trials in blood cancer hold great promise for successful new treatments. Some of the research and the clinical trials are being conducted here in Charlotte at the Levine Cancer Institute, and we've invited several doctors to join us to share what's new and what's on the horizon and what it may mean for those diagnosed with cancer. Dr. Derek Raghavan is back with us. He is the president of the Levine Cancer Institute. Welcome back.
Good morning. Good to be back.
Nice to have you. Dr. Earl Burgess is a medical oncologist there. Good morning to you.
Hello, good morning.
And Dr. Jonathan Gerber is a hematologist and director of the leukemia program at Levine Cancer Institute. Thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. There have been a rash of stories in the national media and some here locally in recent months about the advances in cancer research and treatment, with some promising new therapies on the horizon and some actually being used, either in clinical trials or maybe it's expanded out of that in some cases. Is this just a media blitz, or is something going on in cancer research and treatment in the last year or two or three?
Well, I might start. It's not a media blitz. In the last decade, there's been more progress than probably in the preceding 100 years.
Why?
And I think it relates to the fact that we finally are getting a pretty good handle on what genes drive cancer. As you know, Mike, genes are the parts of the body that pass genetic material from cell to cell or from generation to generation. And we've finally gotten a handle on why cancers begin, what makes them grow, what makes them stop growing. And in fact, John may want to comment. He's been doing some really exciting work in his lab that looks at what gets leukemia started.
You know, I think we finally have a handle on the cells that are at the root of the disease.
Of leukemia.
Of leukemia, and I think the same paradigm holds true for virtually all cancers. So all cancer cells, it turns out, are not created equal, that there are small percentages of cancer stem cells within any tumor, and leukemia is really the hallmark disease for that, where typically less than 1% of the disease is comprised of these stem cells, but they unfortunately are the ones that are capable of regrowing the disease. They're also the ones that are most resistant to our treatments. And as we better understand targets on those cells, as we better understand the genes that drive cancer, as Dr. Raghavan was saying, I think we're beginning to finally get a handle on where we need to target these.
And if I heard you correctly and understand what you had, because you're a doctor, what do I know? But if I understood you correctly, that what we're beginning to understand is that if we understand how one cancer works, we have a clue into how all of them may work. Is that what you fundamentally are saying now?
I think that's very true. At least we all hope that. And I think more and more we're beginning to see common vulnerabilities across the board in cancers. Early on, we used the same drugs to treat cancers. To some degrees, that was successful. To other degrees, it was not. I think more and more, as these immunotherapies are coming on board, we're understanding and seeing that they have capabilities at hitting many cancers.
And what I've read about what's going to happen here in the coming years, is, if you're right about this, is that we're going to move away from this carpet-bombing approach to treating cancer, where you just flood the body with drugs, chemotherapy, or radiation, to a more targeted delivery to the exact spot in the body that's in trouble. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And as they've spoken, a lot of the major advances have been as we've understand the underlying genetic changes that make cancer cells unique and different from normal cells. We've been able, pharmaceutical companies have been able to develop drugs that take advantage of those understood genetic changes. Many of these changes cancer cells are dependent upon new networks are made, if you will, or cellular pathways that tell the cancer cells to grow that are unique. And science, technological advances over the last decade have allowed us to begin to understand these and to define these, and therefore allows the opportunity to develop drugs which target these defects that are specific to cancer cells.
And this was made possible not necessarily because of cancer research, but because of genetic research. Is that right? Or the ability to decode the genome? Is that right?
I think they've worked hand in glove. You know, the same people who are interested in genetics of mm-hmm. normal cells are interested in the genetics of cancer cells. And, you know, one of the interesting points right now is we both look at the genes and the pathways that control growth of cancer cells in parallel with looking at how the normal cells of the body react to drugs and how they metabolize drugs. So oftentimes what we'll do, so for example, if you think about the pain-relieving drug morphine, how the normal cells of the body handle morphine and similar drugs is controlled genetically. So we're now starting to get an idea of what metabolism will occur in an individual. So you, Mike, might have a high tolerance to morphine and need more than someone else. We're getting to the point now where we can actually personalize the treatment, both in terms of the way the normal body cells handle it and how the cancer cells handle it.
Talk to me about the role that the Levine Cancer Institute is playing in all of this. So you came from the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Raghavan, several years ago. You've brought people in now, these two doctors here to my left and right, from Vanderbilt and from Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins, great hospitals, great reputations, but you're attracting physicians and researchers and clinicians from these other institutions. Talk to me about the role that Levine is playing mm-hmm. in all of this.
Well, I think we've developed a pretty elegant cancer research instrument. I will say that Dr. Burgess was actually someone we recruited locally. He did train at Vanderbilt, but he's been here for the past decade or so and doing work of very high quality. As you said, John Gerber and several of his colleagues came in from Johns Hopkins, and we've brought people in from MD Anderson, the University of Arkansas, the Cleveland Clinic, and several other places. I think all up, our total recruitment group of cancer specialists is somewhere around 120, some from here, some from elsewhere. And we've spread around North Carolina and South Carolina. I think the thing that's relatively unique about our model, Mike, is that what we've done is to establish a network that allows people to get treated close to home. Anyone who's been sick knows the last thing you really want to do when you're feeling pain or feeling unwell is to get into a car and go from point A to point B. So if you can cut the travel down by 150 miles, that's a big plus. And so we're doing some quite innovative things. So for instance, we're just about to open a phase one trials unit in Charleston, South Carolina. Phase one trials are what we call first-in-man studies. So we take drugs that are known to work in the test tube. Sometimes they've been tested in some sort of animal model. You see that there is evidence of the ability to kill cancer, and then you say, well, would it work in a human being? So it's a very high-risk approach.
And the object there is not to cure. It's to test dosages and to test whether or not it'll be fatal.
Exactly right. You know, generally, hopefully, it's not fatal, because if it's killed animals, then you're not going to necessarily test it in a human. But the idea is, just as you said, you're trying to get the dose right and see if there's any activity. So we have a 12-bed unit here in Charlotte. We're just about to open a unit in Charleston, and then we're about to start construction on another unit up at Concord. So that will save people traveling.
Now, Charleston has the medical university down there.
They have the medical university and the Roper St. Francis system.
So when you go in, do you go in cooperation with them, or do you put your own facility up?
Well, we've actually built it in our own facility because we function as a single unit. That said, I think the medical university down there is terrific. They've got some old friends of mine. And so wherever we can collaborate, we do. As an example, we have a neuro-oncologist. That's someone who specializes in brain tumors, Ashley Summerall, who we recruited from Duke University some years ago. Ashley does an outreach clinic down there and collaborates with a neuro-oncologist there. We kind of take the view that 1 + 1 = 3. And so the concept is you take two sets of information. put them together, you then add to the experience.
I guess my question is, and just to use Charleston as an example, because I'm sure you have similar outreach in other areas, but if you have a medical university and you have a cancer clinic down there already, why expand there with Levine, except other than business aspects of this, why expand there? Why not go someplace that doesn't have either of those things?
Well, to be honest, we were getting an awful lot of patients referred up here.
Okay.
As I mentioned, my mantra, the thing that didn't work quite so well for me in Cleveland, was that patients would travel hundreds of miles to be at the Cleveland Clinic, and then they would go back to their small rural centers and find it difficult to get the treatments that we recommended. Here, we have operations. We're actually putting patients onto cancer trials in places like Lincolnton, North Carolina, Shelby, North Carolina. We've even opened a unit near Wilmington. Mm-hmm. And so what we believe is if there is a demand and if we're getting patients referred, then we'll try to accommodate the patients. Our first step will be to reach out to the local oncologists and say, would you like to work with us? And so, for example, in Charleston, there are two big groups in community practice who have asked to work with us, and we're making our trials accessible. Mm. The way it works is we have our own data people who look at the data that are generated. We check that everything is done in the way we would do it centrally. So it's pretty tight control.
I was going to ask you if the mission of the Levine Cancer Institute is to treat and care for patients, or is it to conduct clinical research? I guess what I'm hearing from you is it's both.
It's absolutely both. I think there are excellent data, and I don't want to hog the microphone, but I'll answer in the
voice.
I got
plenty of questions for the other.
Okay, great. there are excellent data that show that patients who are in centers that do cancer trials have better outcomes and get better care. Now, that's not to trash in any way people who don't have the ability or the time to do trials, but there is a discipline. What actually happens is all the doctors are up to date. They discuss every case. Their support staff, like nurses and data managers, are engaged. We put a lot of resources in it. It might be a nice time to tip my hat to Leon and Sandra Levine, who made a founder donation for us and allowed us to get this program up and running. Mm. The exciting thing is we've gotten so busy, both in Charlotte and in Shelby and in Lincolnton and in Union County and in Pineville, that we're doing expansion projects in each place. We may well be on the cusp, I hope we are, of putting up a second building. We've got so many programs going.
So what is bringing that, new people. What does that mean for this region, and what does that mean for people who live in this region? This is pretty important stuff.
I think it is. You know, I think the quality of our care is high. You know, we've done a lot of work with agencies that survey our patients, survey our physicians to see how they feel about what we're doing. I think morale amongst the physicians and nurses and support staff is high. The patients seem very pleased. We've basically set a single standard across the system. And so the intention is whether you show up at Union County, at Monroe, at Union Hospital, or whether you go to one of our office facilities, you'll get essentially the same type of treatment, this access to the same trials.
Is this like a snowball? If you build a critical mass of important work being done, and it grows in terms of the region that you're serving because you're putting outposts here and there and everywhere, does that attract? Does it make it easier to attract the talent that you need to really make progress in the research and treatment of cancer?
Well, I think you may want to ask John how he views things that have changed. Earl, how he views things that have changed, and John, what attracted him. I think the simple answer is yes. In addition to the science, one of the things that is a very strong emphasis for us is patient support. So we run a patient navigator academy, and we're doing our fifth one this year, fifth annual one. We have about close to 100 staff whose sole role is to help people through the journey, to make sure that they understand the system.
I will ask Dr. Gerber and Dr. Burgess how things have changed and what attracted them to Levine when we come back, and we'll talk more specifically about leukemia and other cancers and some of the treatments going on and research going on that may change the face of cancer treatment. When we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NS2, presenting The Pixies with special guest John Grant, Tuesday, May 12th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. And Bayer, reminding men with advanced prostate cancer who live with troublesome symptoms to speak up. This can mean the disease has spread to your bones. Keeping discomfort and other symptoms to yourself, especially when you have advanced prostate cancer, can be very dangerous. Talk prostate cancer. .com. In 2011, North Carolina's Republican legislature redrew the political voting maps, and a lot of people saw this as redistricting, or gerrymandering, rather, to favor GOP over the Democrats. Well, the state Supreme Court upheld that redistricting. The U.S. Supreme Court has asked them to review that decision, and we will take a look at all of this, the process and the arguments in play, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the chair of the Federal Election Commission calls the agency worse than dysfunctional and says it may not be able to curb 2016 election abuses. Republicans disagree. Partisan paralysis at the FEC and what can be done about it.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cancer and cancer treatments and breakthroughs in cancer treatment, which seem to be on the rapid increase, and the role that the Levine Cancer Institute here in Charlotte at Carolina's Medical Center is playing in all of this. We want to hear from you. We'd like you to share your thoughts on new research in the treatment of cancer as we go through it and how it can affect individual patients, or maybe it's affected you. Maybe you've been in one of these clinical trials. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, or you can join us via email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Dr. Derek Raghavan is with us, the president of the Levine Cancer Institute, Dr. Earl Burgess, a medical oncologist there, and Dr. Jonathan Gerber, a hematologist and director of the leukemia program, at which a lot of strides have been made. Talk to me, before we talk about individual cancer strides here, talk to me about how things have changed, because you've been here for several years, I guess, Dr. Burgess, how things have changed as Levine has grown, as it's spread out into the surrounding community.
And the creation of the LCI really has brought to town the infrastructure, both in Charlotte centrally and then decentralized, as Dr. Raghavan has spoken. For those of us that are interested in conducting clinical research like myself, we really now have the tools and the key infrastructure, which isn't trivial, to be able to not only participate in clinical trials that have been developed by pharmaceutical companies, but also to develop our own clinical studies locally, which
and,
many of us have
And explain
done.
To me why that's available now and it wouldn't have been available prior to the establishment of Levine.
We did have a rudimentary trials division prior to the establishment of Levine, but frankly, the answer is just the number of personnel, the infrastructure that are required to do clinical research today, from the nurses that tend to patients that are on study, the data coordinators that take in the information and the data about the trial, the people that are responsible for making sure the regulatory component is in place. It just requires a key infrastructure bank that we simply didn't have in town previously.
And what does the collection of expertise, of doctors, talent, what does that do? Because obviously collaboration can be face-to-face.
Once the key infrastructure was built, then it attracted people like Dr. Gerber to come in from out of town at key institutions, now realize that they could do the research that they wanted to do that previously they couldn't. And as you alluded to, having a large collection of physicians interested in clinical research allows for cross-pollination of ideas. And as Dr. Gerber alluded initially, that just because a particular drug may work in leukemia doesn't mean that it might not work in other cancers as well.
You came from Johns Hopkins, Dr. Gerber. That's an internationally known institution. Why leave that to come to little old Charlotte?
I really think this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This was arguably the largest city in the U.S., or certainly one of them, that didn't have a dedicated leukemia program or a dedicated bone marrow transplant program. We performed the first adult allogeneic bone marrow transplant ever in the city back in March of last year. And so that was a rare opportunity to really build from scratch and really build it the right way with the commitment for resources and personnel.
So this is your chance to actually put your stamp on something and build something from the ground up.
I think at least help put my stamp on there.
Well, yeah. Well, congratulations for that. Let's talk about some of the breakthroughs here. And we'll come back and talk about leukemia, too. But let's talk about some of the things. There was a big story on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, about doctors in California and elsewhere using viruses, the polio virus, in some state cases, to go and attack brain tumors. And they've had what appears to be, at least at first glance, some remarkable success. The patient, it's not a pain-free treatment. The patients go through hell, quite honestly. But when they come through the other side of it, the tumor is gone. And the virus is doing what? The virus doesn't do anything. It's inert. It's altered, correct?
Correct.
And the body sees it, the immune system sees it, and goes after the polio virus, and in the process destroys the brain tumor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think, a fair summary. I think that there are a number of less tough ways of treating brain tumors. It's a pretty exciting area at the moment. One of the approaches that we're taking is actually a little gadget that sits like a sort of a skull cap on the outside of the brain, outside of the skull, mm-hmm. and actually passes sort of an electrical current through that actually causes brain tumor cells to shrink. And one of our colleagues, Ed Kim, and Ashley Summerall, the neuro-oncologist I mentioned before, are now about to do a trial that will combine chemotherapy with that sort of approach. I think the reality is these are very exciting times. The brain tumor story is a very interesting one. It's harnessing the body's defenses while also using viruses to get into the cancer and make it more sensitive.
If the immune system will attack the virus and in the process eat up the cancer, why doesn't it attack the cancer and eat it up without any help?
And so, in fact, there are several studies ongoing at the moment. Earl has some experience in these where we can actually bypass the virus piece and simply turn on the immune system. Perhaps you might want to talk about that.
Yeah, why doesn't the immune system go after it in the first place, whatever the cancer
may be? Well, we're learning actually, in fact, that it does. And one of the hallmarks of cancer is that cancer cells have learned to evade the immune system when, in fact, we've learned that tumor cells are often, in many cases, recognized as foreign to the body just as a virus or a bacteria would. But over time, tumors have evolved the ability to evade the immune system. And one of the biggest breakthroughs in the last few years has been the development of medications that allow us to overcome the tumor's ability to turn off the immune system, which then allows the immune system to be activated and do its job and eradicate tumors.
Because the cancer at the very basic level is what? Just cells that are out of control? Is that all it is?
Very simple definition, cells that are growing out of control.
Is it more than that?
It is.
Are they particularly are they different in some way than the normal cell, other than the fact that they're growing out of control?
Oh, absolutely. Cancer cells are inherently genetically unstable, so we would like to hope that normal cells maintain the genetic integrity or the blueprint or the DNA that makes us who we are. Mm-hmm. Another hallmark of cancer cells is they're inherently unstable, so their genes and their blueprints are constantly changing and evolving and mutating into more aggressive and lethal cell types.
And do we understand why that happens in some but not all of our cells?
So there are a number of reasons. You know, one of the things that cancer cells can do is release substances that will actually attract in their own blood supply to strange places where they're growing. So it's sort of like an ideal military invasion. It's creating their own supply chain. They have, in some cases, the potential actually to release substances that we call enzymes that will allow them to burrow into local tissues. Normal cells can't do that. The cancer cells kind of forget to stop growing, and that's driven by genes that control growth regulators on the surface of the cells. That, in turn, opens another target to us. So you might have heard recently that one of our colleagues, Dan Hagstrom, was one of the people who produced a study in the New England Journal of Medicine that was looking at lung cancer and a regulator that is called the epidermal growth factor receptor. That substance controls the rate of growth and the ability to spread of lung cancer cells. Certain mutations in that substance, so changes in that substance, are actually targetable. And so Dan Hagstrom and one of our colleagues, Ed Kim, brought the study to this city. We recruited a number of patients in, remember we were talking about a phase one trial, first in man trial. They were in the dose finding phase, found a number of patients that both responded where the cancer shrank and those responses were sustained.
There was an article in The Observer about Dr. Hagstrom over the weekend.
Correct.
He used a drug called AZD9291, which targets a subset of lung tumors that have mutated. What is AZD9291?
So it's exactly that. It's a targeted therapy that locks onto mutated epidermal growth factor receptor. If you think, the way I conceptualize it is a relatively, I'm a simple thinker. I think of a lock and key mechanism. The lock accepts a key which turns and lets the lock be activated or not. In this case, with the mutations in that epidermal growth factor substance, you can stop the cell from growing. It's a very elegant way, and it's so focused on the cancer cell that the level of side effects is actually much gentler than many of the chemotherapy drugs.
So AZD9291 is a gene therapy, essentially. No, it's not.
No, it's, I guess we'd call it a targeted therapy.
What's the difference between a targeted therapy and a gene therapy, which is also targeted to your particular situation?
They're both arguably targeted therapies. The this inhibitor is a small molecule that mimics a natural substance in the body and can lock on and replace it. Or block the natural substance from sticking to into that keyhole. The gene therapies, are ones that are capable of reprogramming the cells or delivering in some instances either a new target into the cells or in other instances trying to actually repair the damage. You know, fundamentally, at its essence, cancer is a problem where a cell was injured. It either should have repaired the damage or it should have self-destructed. And if neither happened, the immune system should have cleaned it up and gotten rid of it. And if none of those three things happen, you end up with a cancer cell.
So because you're giving a patient a drug, AZD9291, and I think it's in pill form, which is probably much more pleasant than the 4 hours with the
drip,
is that still considered a chemotherapy of sorts?
It depends on how loosely you use the term chemotherapy. If you include chemotherapy as drug therapy, yes. If you think of it as conventional chemotherapy that causes nausea and makes people's hair fall out and and sort of has all the inherent side effects that we associate with cancer therapies, no. It's a very different treatment, much more tolerable.
Targeted gene – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say John's comments just remind me of some really exciting work that's being done in Charlotte by our collaborators at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. So Dr. Bob Wilhelm and Dr. Phil Dubois have recruited a series of cancer researchers to UNC Charlotte, one of whom came from the Mayo Clinic. Her name is Pinku Mukherjee. And Dr. Mukherjee is working in another very tough field of pancreas cancer, and we have a collaboration with her. She's developed a similar approach using antibodies, and antibodies are chemicals that can recognize, again, the sort of lock and key concept, they can recognize characteristics on the surface of cancer cells so that they sort of lock into the cancer cell and either turn off growth or present a kind of irregular target that the body's immune system can spot. Mm. What Dr. Mukherjee has done that's so exciting is, and the reason I mention it, is it's another piece of the puzzle. Her antibody can be used diagnostically. So she's developing a blood test that will allow us to spot early growth of pancreas cancer. I view pancreas cancer as still our toughest target. And so the ability to spot it early and manage it or treat it or cure it before it spread, very exciting possibility.
Some of these treatments that I've been reading about sound like you have a handle on making cancer a chronic disease for some people, that's something you continue to treat over the course of a lifetime, but it doesn't kill them.
Yes, and that's very much the case. A number of the new this term targeted therapy is probably used too loosely, but it's a nice simple term that says it's not chemo, which basically blows up the cancer cells. It actually turns them off. Mm-hmm. There's a drug called Gleevec that's been around now, I guess, for 15, 20 years that's turned some of the leukemias into a chronic disease. A type of muscle tumor called sarcoma also into a chronic disease. So you're absolutely right, Mike. When I started 30, 35 years ago, you know, the death rate from cancer, all types of cancer, was incredibly high. My year as a resident, leukemia killed probably 90-95% of its victims. Now we're curing 30-40% using either new treatments, targeted treatments, or bone marrow transplant. Jonathan Gerber mentioned the fact that we'd set up a marrow transplant unit here at the Levine. Later this year, I think we'll hit our 100th transplant. There's a demand, and so previously patients would have to go to other cities for a 6 to 8 week period and then follow-up treatment, whereas now that's able to be done here, and we've had some really great initial results. The most dangerous time for bone marrow transplant is the time when the patient is most vulnerable. Mm. And that being the case, we're now keeping patients in this area and getting really terrific results.
I believe, Dr. Burgess, you said that personalized treatment has become a goal of leukemia treatment. Is that true? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think for a number of years we've gotten smarter as time has gone on that in trying to identify which cancers, which leukemia specifically, are going to be incurable with standard chemotherapy and which ones we have to jump to a bone marrow transplant for. We do a pretty good job at identifying the worst of the worst. What we don't do a great job of is identifying what we call the favorable risk leukemias. Right. Everything's relative. That's about a 50-50 prognosis. And so we still have a very poor handle on who's going to be in each 50%. One of the focuses of my research has been in identifying those leukemia stem cells at the root of the disease. Right. Basically, the theory holds that if you wipe those leukemia stem cells out, someone is cured. If you don't, it's akin to mowing dandelions, that you've made things look nice, you've put the patient into remission, but ultimately the disease is going to come back. And so the research that we've done is actually to try to identify who is cured and who is not cured after they've received mm-hmm. their first wave of treatment.
I called you Dr. Burgess, and you're doctor, clearly Dr. Gerber, and I apologize for that. This leukemia is a blood cancer.
Right.
Is blood cancer particularly challenging because it's a fluid and it's everywhere in the body?
It is and it isn't. So, yes, by its nature, it's everywhere at once. So we typically worry when solid tumors have metastasized out of the organ that they started in, that those tumors are much more difficult to treat and usually not curable. For blood cancers, they've already spread from the moment they're diagnosed. Everywhere the blood goes, the leukemia mm-hmm. has free rein to travel as well. It's also a very, very, very proliferative organ. So we make about 500 billion new blood cells per day. And you can just imagine that if you turn that into the wrong hands, just how destructive that could be, just churning out cells and cells and cells by the minute. And so it can be a deadly disease literally within a few days to a few months.
Wow.
On the flip side, we do cure folks with just chemotherapy, and we cure even more folks using bone marrow transplant.
So talk about that, because we've opened the region's first and really only bone marrow and blood marrow transplant for patients with aggressive types of blood cancer. This has been described as a game changer. Why?
You know, I think, as Dr. Raghavan alluded to earlier, patients were traveling a minimum of 2 to 3 hours to get treatment for these diseases. And they're traveling when they're at their sickest, their most vulnerable states to try to – it's very, very difficult with an explosive disease like that to try to coordinate the timing between two centers. And so really, I think in very many ways they were getting suboptimal care. And I think now having a transplant center close to home, it's allowed them to stay near their families, near their critical supports. It's enabled them to get closer monitoring, and you know, there's never necessarily a safe time when you finally cut the ties, and so they're always now monitored.
You know, a bone marrow transplant is not like a kidney transplant or a heart transplant. The word transplant scares the heck out of people, so tell me exactly what happens in the process of a bone marrow transplant for a leukemia patient.
Sure. The principle of it is that it's sort of the grandfather of all immunotherapies. So we're really using the donor, the person who's donating the bone marrow or blood for the transplant, we're using their immune system and putting it into somebody else to cure the cancer. So where the patient's own immune system didn't recognize the leukemia or other disease as foreign and kill it or as a mistake, this new immune system typically will. When it actually goes in, we can now collect the blood stem cells that we need to pull from the donor. We can collect them off the blood. We don't have to harvest their marrow, although sometimes we still do.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break, and we'll come back and get a further explanation of what goes on in that. I also want to talk about targeted gene therapy as well. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Bank. PNC helps customers achieve their financial goals with the Premium Money Market account. Information about its features is available at pnc.com/savings. And the UNC system, offering over 100 flexible online programs in education to help you become a North Carolina teacher. Options at programs.northcarolina.edu. The chair of the Federal Election Commission calls the agency worse than dysfunctional and says it may not be able to curb 2016 election abuses. But Republicans don't agree. A look at partisan paralysis at the FEC and what can be done about it. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you have questions about what we're talking about this morning, cancer and cancer research, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
We've been watching violence on the streets of Baltimore.
Too many people have spent generations building up this city.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
North Carolina's five public historically black universities are trying to carve out niches for themselves.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cancer, specifically about cancer treatments and breakthroughs in research, and research being conducted even as we speak at Levine Cancer Institute here in Charlotte with Dr. Derek Raghavan, president of that organization. Dr. Earl Burgess is with us, a medical oncologist there, and Dr. Jonathan Gerber, the hematologist and director of the leukemia program at Levine Cancer Institute. Just prior to the break, Dr. Gerber, you were talking about what exactly happens in the course of a transplant for a marrow transplant for leukemia. So continue that line of thought.
Sure, and specifically we were talking about allogeneic transplant. I should add that there are really two flavors of transplant. There is an auto transplant where we actually take the patient's bone marrow out. We give them very high doses of chemotherapy, higher than you would traditionally be able to, that would actually kill the marrow. Allows you to get enough chemotherapy in to actually kill the cancer, and you salvage the patient at the last minute by giving them their own bone marrow back.
Bone marrow is where the blood cells are manufactured.
Correct. Okay. Correct. All the blood cells are made there. For the allogeneic transplants, we're actually using a different person, typically a relative, and we're taking either blood or bone marrow cells. You can collect either, and so for the donor, it can just be collected off of their blood. It's a much more palatable procedure from their perspective to take the blood. And it actually goes into the patient just like a blood transfusion. So the cells are actually smart enough to find their way back into the patient's marrow, repopulate it, and start to go to work.
You also have a state-of-the-art stem cell processing lab now. What are the implications of that? How is it used? What's the impact of it?
Correct. So we process our own transplants in-house, and so it really enables us to take on any type of transplant that we need to. The donor can be collected at the same place that the patient is being treated. We can freeze the cells and store them if we need to under some circumstances. We can also store cells for future use to boost the transplant at a later date.
We have a lot of ground to cover, but I do want to talk a little bit about targeted gene therapy. Not to completely switch gears, but we've just done it. It's an emerging field. Exactly what is it, and what has enabled us to do this all of a sudden?
Well, the question you ask and the concept of personalized medicine and gene therapy in that context really, I think, is where a lot of the enthusiasm and excitement exists today. And the concept is this. What we've called, for example, prostate or bladder cancer in the past, we're learning as we understand the genetics that make the tumors that what one may call a bladder cancer, that there may be molecular subgroups of bladder cancer that behave differently. So the analogy I like to use is of a gumball machine. If you can imagine a big gumball machine, there's a lot of red balls and green ones and white ones. Collectively, it may be called a bladder cancer, but what really matters is what's the proportion of the different colors or the different molecular phenotypes that underlie those. And so where the concept of personalized medicine comes in is the ability to recognize that one patient with a bladder tumor, for example, may have a higher proportion of green gumballs or that subtype of cell, whereas another patient may have a higher proportion of red gumballs or that molecular subtype. And the key is in recognizing that the different subtypes or the color gumballs, if you will, can predict both how a patient may do and may predict a patient's response to therapy. And so the concept of personalized medicine is our increasing ability across all tumor types to recognize the subgroups of patients with a common diagnosis, bladder cancer, for example, and recognize this patient has this subtype and therefore these therapies may be more effective and an alternate patient may have a different subtype.
Are we ahead in certain areas in being able to use that? Are certain types of cancer ahead of the game in using these therapies than others?
Absolutely, no question.
Such as?
Breast cancer, lung cancer have probably the best developed, best recognized subgroups and then have developed medications, for example, the AZD drug that you mm-hmm. referenced. That applies only to a certain subgroup of patients, but we now have the ability to identify and detect those and therefore have a weapon to give to just those patients. Drug doesn't work in patients that don't have the mutations, so we don't administer it in that setting.
Our Michael Tomczyk from WFAE News did a story talking to researchers recently trying to answer a question, should we be treating tumors based on their mutations or on their tissue of origin? A theory being, if I understood it correctly, is that cancer cells' mutations is what we should be focusing on rather than whether it's a bladder cancer or a prostate cancer or a lung cancer, because in the final analysis, perhaps cancer is cancer?
So this is interesting because it was another story that was covered in 60 Minutes a little earlier in the year. And I think that oftentimes people in research try to push their own barrow rather than accepting that there's more than one way to skin the cat. Mm-hmm. So the truth is that you can do both. You know, there are clearly characteristics that go with a particular tissue of origin. So, for instance, malignant melanoma, very aggressive, very nasty type of skin cancer due to excessive sun exposure. In the last 5 to 10 years, we have absolutely revolutionized the treatment of that tumor when it's spread throughout the body. And that's been done on two bases. Number one, we've already talked about harnessing the immune system to turn it on to recognize melanoma cells. And then a second has been identifying a gene called BRAF, R-A-F, which is expressed and mutated in melanoma, and we now have an agent that locks onto that mutated gene and turns off growth. The reason I mention it is that in my rather long career, the first 25, 30 years, just about everybody with metastatic melanoma, melanoma that had spread through the body, would die within about a year. There was a small subset of people that responded to immune treatments that were not very carefully targeted that would survive longer. Now, even people with brain involvement, so the cancer has gotten into the brain and is damaging the brain, will respond to these types of targeted treatment. So it's both a combo of immunotherapy. Once that stopped working, if that happens, then you can use the targeted therapy. And so the idea there is it's a particular pattern of gene expression. Those same drugs may not work necessarily as well in tumors arising from other sites, like, say, the testis or like, say, the bone marrow. However, there'll be other specific treatments that will apply. So what we're doing now is both. We're sorting where the tumors came from. So someone like Dr. Burgess, while he's a general oncologist, has subspecialty interest in cancers of the prostate, the bladder, the testis and the kidney. They all kind of run in a pack. Mm-hmm. We'll have a different team that's doing breast cancer work and a different team that's doing gastrointestinal cancer work. I might say, interestingly, that one of the other things we haven't mentioned is our new leader of the gastrointestinal cancer medical program, Dr. Jimmy Huang, came to us from Georgetown University Cancer Center, and he has just established our first training program in this region. Mm. So we're going to be training cancer specialists here in Charlotte.
Is immunotherapy a subset of gene therapy, or is it the same thing? Because you're kind of targeting some specific thing in the body to treat the cancer.
So they overlap. So immunotherapy is simply turning on the body's immunity. There are a number of ways of doing that, which include playing with the genes that regulate or control the growth of immune cells. There's a gene called PD-L1 that is very active in turning on one of the types of immune cells called T lymphocytes. But there are other ways of turning on immunity. Gene therapy is a broad term that relates to using the genes one way or another. As John Gerber said a moment ago, you can insert new genes, you can put in little bits of chemical that will replace a missing bit of gene. Mm-hmm. So I think the truth is there's a lot of overlap between immunotherapy, gene therapy, and targeted therapy.
You've referenced Dr. Edward Kim, one of your doctors at Levine Cancer Institute, and we, Michael Tomczyk from WFAE News had a chance to talk to him, and we have a comment from him about one of these therapies. I'm not sure which one he's talking about. I want you to hear this and tell me what he's thinking about, because what he's saying is really exciting if you have cancer, at least. This is Dr. Edward Kim.
They don't suppress your blood counts. They don't give you tons of fatigue. You don't lose your hair. These are all positive things. And many times, they're pills. I have a patient I'm still following from Houston who's been on a pill for stage 4 lung cancer for over 8 years. Median survival in stage 4 lung cancer with treatment, 50% at 1 year. So just amazing stuff that you can see.
Immunotherapy or gene therapy or something else?
I'm thinking that's probably one of the targeted therapies. So it is identifying a gene mutation and turning off the function of that gene mutation. And we're seeing that sort of pattern of long-term survival increasingly.
And if we see it working with one particular cancer, does it follow that it will probably work in another cancer if it's modified in some way?
Yeah, and I think this kind of speaks to the tissue of origin versus the molecular features. I think that if tumors come from different backgrounds but they share the same molecular defect, the same drug may work in multiple settings. So there may be subsets within any given cancer that drug may work for, and there are other subsets that it wouldn't. By the same token, you, to some extent, or that the cancers are who they came from, and so there is a tremendous amount of or constellation of genes that are turned on or off in a given cell that partly derive from where they were born, what tissue they came from. And so it's a combination of both, that there may be therapies that cross those boundaries of tissue, and we need to identify which individuals would benefit from them, and hence the personalization. I think there are also instances in which we do have to treat each one separately, and we really do need to identify new targets on each. More and more we are finding that the immune system, when it works well or when we can boost it, can identify abnormalities across the board and actually hit a variety of cancers.
Let me share with you some of the comments and questions that have been coming in as we've been talking here. And I'll, for the people who have questions about particular problems, the doctors cannot diagnose over the radio, but we can take a stab at answering some of these questions. Lais on our website: when I was being treated at Duke for ALL leukemia from 2010 to 2011, I found little information about immunotherapy online. But when I asked about it, my oncologist claimed to know nothing about it, so I went to another for more information and was told that with a 40% chance of survival, I should stay with the tried and true. While I'm grateful for everyone who helped develop the chemo protocol, that was a tough 2 years, and no one tells you that you run a great risk of dying from infection. Should the doctors up at Duke have known about immunotherapy? Seems to me they should have.
I'm sure they probably knew about it. It's not so. Again, bone marrow transplant is the hallmark. It's the mother of all immunotherapies, if you will, and the nuclear option. They certainly are expert in that, and just may not have been alluding to that when they had the discussion.
Or perhaps
the other therapies are newer.
Or perhaps that person was not a candidate,
and likely had a good chance of being cured with chemotherapy, which is a less risky approach. No one's saying it's pleasant, but it definitely is less risky.
Okay.
One of the things, too, that we haven't touched on is really how the pace of drug discovery has changed in just the last decade. And Dr. Raghavan can comment on this from his past experience, that a lot of the new immunotherapies that we all share such excitement and enthusiasm for have only been really developed in the last 2 to 3 years. And as a result of the technological advances of understanding the basis of cancer, we've been able to expedite the pace of drug discovery such that the time from the lab to the bedside that drugs are able to be developed has increased considerably.
Why is that? Why has that happened?
You know, I think it's investment, to be honest, Mike. You know,
on whose part?
The community, donors, us. You know, we do more than just treat patients with known drugs. You know, that's our ethos, is we do research that's built into our clinical programs. I have on my payroll more than 100 people in our cancer trials unit. That's a very strong commitment to cancer research, and so you have to have the ability to invest in doing the work.
Some of these drugs, traditional drugs, chemotherapy drugs, and some of these new drugs are monstrously expensive. You wrote an article recently, Dr. Raghavan, about Medicaid, in which you said that no patient with cancer should lack health insurance that guarantees access to high-quality cancer care, and that patients with cancer on Medicaid should receive care equivalent to that received by those with private insurance. Do they not?
I think in some cases they don't. One of the things that really attracted me to Carolina's healthcare, and I'm really proud of, is our boss, Michael Tarwater, has repeatedly stated, we are the safety net and we won't abandon our patients. You know, we do a large amount of indigent care, a large amount of care for people who are uninsured, and our results suggest that they get exactly the same results.
What role has the Affordable Care Act played in helping people get care, if any?
I think it's helped in some cases. The problem with the Affordable Care Act is the variability throughout the USA. Different states will take federal support, others won't. Currently in North Carolina,
we don't.
But Carolina's healthcare system has gone on record again and again in saying, we will treat these patients. We have huge numbers in the Cancer Institute of indigent programs where we actually provide screening, education, and in some cases treatment to people who need the care.
Very quickly, two prostate cancer questions. Dennis in Mooresville, I have stage 4 prostate cancer. I've had 42 radiation treatments, 3-plus years of ADT therapy, and Provenge treatment 1 year ago. What's new out there in clinical trials that might benefit me? It is all about me.
There are a whole bunch of new drugs. Dr. Burgess is very well versed in treating a series of new anti-cancer agents, both chemotypes and second-line hormonal drugs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. In just the last few years, there have been multiple new medications which really target what's called the androgen axis, that many prostate cancers are dependent upon the male hormone testosterone in the activity, and that it promotes growth of cancer cell. And many of the new agents that have been developed and approved and are widely used target that axis.
And Ed follows up with another question. Why is the PSA test being discouraged by some entities? I believe the PSA test saved lives. I know 4 men myself whose lives have been saved by having routine PSA tests.
Mike, that's a one-hour discussion. The short answer is there are many different types of prostate cancer, and a lot of people who have a rising PSA will run the risk of being over-treated. When you look at all the people who've had PSA testing versus those who don't have it, at the end of a 10, 15, 20-year period, you don't tend to save a lot of lives by that type of testing.
Dr. Derek Raghavan is president of the Levine Cancer Institute, Dr. Earl Burgess, medical oncologist there, and Dr. Jonathan Gerber, hematologist and director of the leukemia program at Levine Cancer Institute. Exciting times out there, and thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.